Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Tuesday, March 26th. My name is Magnus Tiewald. I'm your host for this morning. We have a bunch of different things lined up for you today. We have a Rendezvous Francophonie presentation with an interview with Victoria King. For those of you carrying over from the previous program, we have an interesting presentation on the Haudenosaunee language, part of a series called Words and Culture, in which they talk about the language and how it works and the different variations. Really interesting. So that's going to be coming up in about 20 minutes or so. So hopefully you'll stick around for that if you were here for the previous program. We have some good music. Some other stuff as well. Don't forget, coming up at 11 o'clock this morning is Democracy Now! And let's get going. So before we get into the rest of the program, I want to talk a little bit about what's happening in Gaza these days. We haven't addressed that very much on this program. And in many ways, I feel bad about that. But it's such a difficult topic, and it feels like we can only touch on it in the smallest way here with the resources we have, which often feels inadequate. But I did want to talk about something that is happening in Gaza right now, and that is the prospect of famine. A lot of the discussion that goes on these days is about whether or not there should be a ceasefire. And in my opinion, there really should be a ceasefire, because what's happening there is really a horrible, horrible tragedy. The politics of it are difficult, though. I don't support the strategies of the Israeli government and the Israeli military, but nor do I support the positions of Hamas and their holding of the hostages. Now, it doesn't seem like the holding of 100 hostages should be worth the deaths of what is now 30,000 people in Gaza, at least 20,000 of them civilians. That just seems crazy. And I think if this was any other conflict in any other part of the world, we'd all be aghast. And of course, many people are. But because it's Israel-Palestine, we all sort of stand around and rubber heads. Well, many people, and the sort of general position of media and whatnot is we all stand around, rub our foreheads in confusion and wondering what can be done. But one thing that's happening right now in Gaza is the prospect of famine. And make no mistake, this is an entirely man-made famine. It's created by the refusal of the Israeli government to allow sufficient aid trucks into the territory to feed the population, which is much of it, which is gathered in the southern part of the Gaza Strip around Ramallah. So the lack of food in the territory in Gaza is entirely a product of the sealing of the borders of Gaza, which is part of the military strategy of Israel. But the thing is, how necessary is this for their military strategy? I think if you understand how things work in conflicts, you'd know that a pause in operations, a pause in fighting, almost always benefits the weaker party because it allows them to gather themselves and with the lack of pressure from active fighting, it allows them to gather and reorganize and regroup and be ready for things to continue when they do, which is a big reason why Israel is not willing to have a ceasefire of any length, at any rate, because they see that as giving up advantage to the Hamas fighters. Now, there's a whole, you know, is that justified? That's a different question than I'm talking about today. And that's been well discussed because, again, you know, the scale of death and destruction in Gaza is generally appalling. But the whole issue of food is different. You know, I mean, I suppose the reason Israel is restricting aid trucks coming in is because they feel that perhaps that's a way for materials supportive of Hamas to slip into the area, which they've got completely sealed off. But, you know, there are alternatives to simply having trucks come in from the Egypt crossing at the southern end of the strip. You know, all the aid could be delivered to Israel, and the Israelis could go through it with whatever fine-tooth comb they feel they need before passing it back to the UN or whoever would be the agency providing it and moving it into the territory. That's not happening, though. And the really only conclusion you can get then is that Israel is hoping to use hunger and famine as one of their tactics in their conflict with Hamas. And that, to me, is simply not acceptable. And I think by the standards of international agreements would actively represent a war crime to target a civilian population with starvation just to advance your military strategy and goals. There are solutions to get food in there. You know, maybe they could just trust it to the United States to be the people. Everything goes through some American thing. And again, there's ways to make sure that, you know, no military components, supplies, resources are moving into the country so that people can get enough food to eat. And that needs to happen. Something needs to happen because the current situation can't continue. What's happening there is it's really unprecedented, you know, in the combination of both the scale of what's happening and the lack of international resolve to call out what's happening and to do something about it. And it's appalling to see. There is no excuse for famine in Gaza, and the international community really needs to do something about it. And that probably means that the United States needs to put the requisite pressure on Israel to make sure that food and medicine and other essential resources for survival of the people there can get in there. All right. We have a presentation or an interview from as part of the Rendezvous Francophonie series of interviews with Rendezvous Francophonie is an annual celebration celebrating the French language throughout the world and in the many places where it is spoken as a first or a second language. Of course, here in Canada, we're one of the chief Francophone countries after France, with one of the largest, or perhaps the largest, population of native French speakers outside of France. So, of course, it's an important initiative for us here in Canada. This series is produced by our national association, the National Campus Community Radio Association. I hope you enjoy this. This is an interview conducted by Catherine Fisher with Victoria King, a programmer at one of our sister stations. And I hope you Enjoy this. Remember, coming up just after this, this interview is our segment from the Words and Culture series. Today, they'll be talking about the Haudenosaunee language, which is the language group representing the Huron and Mohawk peoples, generally speaking, in Ontario and the sort of northeast Great Lakes area of the United States. So New York State and the upper New England states. That'll be coming up at in about 15 minutes after this segment. So please enjoy. This is Rendezvous Francophonie with Catherine Fisher and Victoria King.
Welcome to the Franco Podcast. Welcome to the 2024 Rendezvous de la Francophonie podcast. I interviewed 8 bilingual or multilingual people for this year's podcast, including Victoria King. Victoria is a manager at a charitable foundation in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and previously worked in the community radio sector. Here's our conversation.
I'm wondering, what's the value of speaking more than one language for you?
For me, it's kind of a benefit that I think I have when it comes to looking for jobs and opportunities is a big one for me. The value I also have found that in my life, I've done a bit of traveling and it is definitely really exciting and beneficial when I go somewhere new and I can connect with people in another language and in their language, because French is not my first language. So yeah, it does open doors, which is cliche, but it really does. And I also just think the value or the benefit is that I remember learning French and it challenged my brain to think in a new way. And it still does. Like when I hear it on the radio or if I'm watching a movie or something, I kind of have to focus a little more. And I think it's good for my brain. It makes it work a little bit harder.
How about, does it kind of open up new avenues in terms of books and music and movies you mentioned?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think actually books is a good one. So my husband is the assistant manager at McNally Robinson Booksellers, which is an independent bookstore in Winnipeg. And he took French in school and learned French. And in his adult life, he's read books in French. And there's sort of a, depending on the book and the author, there's a really unique difference culturally and, you know, in the tone and everything, reading something in a new language. And I do think that it makes a huge difference to read something in its original language as opposed to a translation. There's nothing wrong with a translation, but I do think that there are, I think that there's probably nuances that are difficult to capture or challenging to capture when you apply translation to something. So that makes it pretty unique.
When did you start to learn French and how did that learning progress for you?
I started to learn French in school, in grade school. I was in English. All my courses were in English all through elementary school. And then when I was in junior high, I went to a junior high that offered late immersion. So it meant that you could start taking, you know, all your courses in French starting in grade 7. My husband, by contrast, he started learning French in, I think, kindergarten or grade 1, and he did all of his school in French. So I went to a school that offered late immersion, and then I actually did extra late immersion. So I was always in English until about the end of grade 8, and then I switched to French immersion in grade 9, and I did French immersion in grades 9 through, I think, 11 and 12. I had always enjoyed French. I'd always done pretty well with it. And then it just kind of happened that all of my friends in junior high were in French. And I really liked, there was a different mood in the classes. And I was really challenged by it at sort of a nice level where I felt like it was difficult. I was learning new things, but it wasn't so hard that it was totally out of my grasp. I remember it being really difficult, but I do remember that it it was actually much better to have no other option. Like the fact that you could only speak French and like the teachers would not, you know, give in to you and speak English made it the learning a lot more efficient. And it made me try a lot harder. And I had really great teachers. Like I went to it's a public school, it was Monroe Junior High in Winnipeg. And at a certain point, I don't know when it happened, but it just got easier and easier. And there were always, there will always be things that I still am challenged by and with French, but yeah, over time it just got easier. And, you know, neither of my parents speak any French, and they didn't put me in French immersion because my mom had always said, well, we thought if you brought home homework, we wouldn't be able to help you. We wouldn't know the language. So we couldn't, that's why we didn't put you in French. Yeah. And then in first year university, I ended up doing a study abroad course and I went to the south of France, and that was great. Like I went with a few Canadians and Americans, and it was interesting to see pretty much all the Americans learn like elementary, like basic French, and sort of for myself and a lot of the other Canadians be able to move through the country and the classes a lot easier, mostly get it. It's been a long time since I've used my French daily, but it still comes back, which sometimes I'm surprised by. I listen to something, I'm like, oh yeah, no, I definitely still know what they're saying. And again, I still think the best way to learn it is to be forced to use it, you know, to have no other choice, that's the only language you're allowed to speak. You just learn fast, which is pretty amazing, actually, how we can adapt.
Do you find anything difficult about being bilingual?
I do find it used to, I didn't appreciate it when I was learning the language, and I still find it really challenging now, is just remembering that the like structure and patterns of the phrasing and the grammar is not just easy translate into English. It's not just knowing the words and replacing them. It's the actual like structure of the verbs and the pronouns and everything go in a different order. I find that very challenging. Yeah. And maybe just keeping it up is challenging. You know, I'm shy now about speaking in French. Even though I think if I sat at a table and people were speaking, I'd get it, or I could read the newspaper and I'd be fine. I'm very reluctant to say anything in French because I haven't kept it up.
When you're fluent in English already and you can talk about sophisticated things, I'm even at my beginner level of French, it's just really hard to, you know, to be at a lower level.
Yeah.
Is there another language that you'd love to learn?
I think that learning German would be, I'd love to learn German. My mother's side of the family is German, and my grandparents spoke German to each other. And her family immigrated to Canada in the early 1920s. And I think that my grandma used to teach me a bit of German when I was young. And so I don't remember much at all, but it's such a unique and like somewhat strange language to me. I don't hear it spoken often, and I don't hear it popularly, you know, on the radio or the television. But just it would make me think of my grandparents. So learning German would be pretty interesting.
So this podcast series is going to be aired on campus community and Indigenous radio stations across the country to celebrate the Rendezvous de la Francophonie. You want to tell me a little bit about your long history with community radio?
So I first got involved with community radio in 2010, September of 2010, as a student at the University of Winnipeg. And then it really just kind of snowballed from there. I started doing a show at CKUW. Over time, after a period of time, I also became staff at the station. I was the volunteer coordinator for 3.5 years. And then I was the full-time program director for 2 years. I also served on the board of the NCRA, and I've done a lot of different kinds of radio. I had a music show for 9 years, almost 9 years. I hosted on a morning show. I produced a radio documentary at one point. So it's been just a constant in my life, and I think it helped me build more of my identity in my adult life, and it connected me to people and communities in this city in Winnipeg that mean a lot to me now. And yeah, introduced me to local music, which was a ongoing interest of mine, just to see what music is coming out and what people are making. And it's been, you know, there's been stops and starts to it too, where I've taken a break or I've stepped away for a while, but I think it's nice. I feel like with campus radio, you know, that's a normal thing. It takes a lot of energy to make radio and a lot of thoughtfulness and attention. So I like the idea that maybe I can come back to it at different points in my life and try new things and also step away when I have other things in my life, you know? And I do think that actually makes it a nice environment for everyone, you know, that you have different people coming in as leaders or as, you know, thought makers or whatever, and this ongoing cycle of people coming through. Can I ask you what inspired you to, so it's recently that you've been learning French, right?
Yes.
Okay. What inspired that?
Well, honestly, actually, I'd always thought I wasn't very good at French because maybe I didn't give it enough attention when I was in school, or, you know, I don't know. For some reason, my mind was elsewhere. And then when I was actually hired as a contractor to start this blogging contract with the Dialogue Foundation as an Anglophone, I thought, you know, this would be an amazing time to start learning French. So I mm-hmm. just started with Duolingo because coincidentally I was having a coffee with a friend who said, "Oh, I'm learning Spanish on Duolingo," and I said, "What's Duolingo?" And you know, mm-hmm. I got the précis on that. And I started doing daily lessons, and I'm continuing to do daily lessons. And, you know, I've gotten past the elementary school stage, and I might be in the, well, I don't know, maybe I'm grade six now or something. So it's
yeah.
been a while, but I have to admit the subject matter's not that interesting when you're reading at that level, but I've actually started kind of in the last year, I've started writing emails in French and reading emails in French with a dictionary, which is a little more interesting. I actually get kind of a rush when I successfully write an email without too many
yeah.
mistakes.
My husband, once in a while, when we're out or something, we'll play a game of trying to remember what certain things are in French. Or be like, what's the French word for nose or elbow or pinky, you know? Mm-hmm. And he's always really good at it. And I struggle, but his French is beautiful. When he speaks it, it's really nice. But
does he have a family roots in French?
No, no, it was just, well, his mom was a teacher.
Ah.
His mom was an educator. So I think that they really saw the value in his dad. I mean, I don't know that this really matters, but like his dad is Portuguese, first generation Canadian. So I do think that even though his dad doesn't speak Portuguese, I think that he at least had some concept of being bilingual.
Yeah.
And actually, oh, this is an important to the interview right now, but I went on a tour at the University of Winnipeg the other day. And we were touring the psychology department, and one of the researchers is doing research into like the brain and bilingualism and how the brain lights up with different, like acquiring different languages, or like how our brain relies on one language to learn another. And she was saying, I didn't know this, but it makes a lot of sense. She said it's actually less common in the world to be monolingual, that more of the world mm-hmm. speaks more than one language than just one.
That was my conversation with Victoria King, who lives in Winnipeg, Manitoba. This year's Rendezvous de la Francophonie partners and funders include the Government of Canada, the Linguistic Portal of Canada, the National Film Board, Air Canada, La Fédération de la Jeunesse Canadienne Française, NAF Canada, and many other groups, including the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
This is Bird Note. In Panama, thousands of army ants on the march, looking for prey, are a fearsome sight. As the ants pass through the leaf litter, they stir up countless grasshoppers, cockroaches, beetles, and even lizards that flee in terror. Flying insects may escape from the ant infantry, but they're no match for the aerial threat from this oscillated ant bird. Clinging to a thin plant stem above the fray, the blue-faced oscillated ant bird waits for flying insects to leave their hiding spots, then swoops in to catch them. As many as 29 bird species have such a tight bond with the ants that they can't survive without them. They have to find an army ant column to follow every day. And birds aren't the only group of animals that need the ants. Scientists have estimated that about 300 species of animals survive only by sticking with army ants. From tiny mites clinging to the ants to butterflies that feed on ant bird droppings, it's thought to be the largest association of animals tied to a single species in the world. Rainforest fragmentation is a big threat to army ants and their followers, which need large expanses of forest to find enough food. Learn how you can help support conservation efforts in Panama and beyond at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Remmel.
All right. Do you remember that story, Leningen and the Ants? It was like a short story we did, I think it was in elementary school, and a dramatic story of the march of army ants overrunning somebody's farm and his Leningen's struggle to contain it. Anyway, many years ago, that's a blast from the past. Let's take a quick look at the weather here. It's going to be rainy for the next couple of days. Showers and periods of rain throughout, highs to 12 degrees or so, and lows down to a moderate 5 or 6 degrees overnight. Friday, things are going to brighten up, and it looks like we're going to have sunny but cool weather through the week, for the whole long weekend. Highs up anywhere from 14 to 16, and lows down to 3 or 4 degrees overnight. Maybe not quite beach weather yet, but it's going to be great for getting out for hikes and walks and other sitting on patios with coffee and other nice activities like this. Here now is our presentation of Words and Culture, and they're talking about the Haudenosaunee languages. So I hope you enjoy this.
Sego.
Buju. Anim.
Danach. Ak anzenu shuk with an.
Tante.
Ay, inuhadikai.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Sego, skenega. Over the next 6 episodes, I'm going to introduce you to language speakers and language learners from 6 nations of the Grand River Territory. We will learn about what drives their passion to keep our languages alive and how they're doing it in different ways. We're going to hear music composed and sung in the language, and who knows, you may even pick up some words. But Words and Culture is more than just 6 episodes of the Haudenosaunee language family. Throughout the next several months, we're going to have other hosts introduce you to more Indigenous languages, including Inuktitut, Cree, Anishinaabe Mohawk, and the Athabaskan language family. My name is January, January Rogers, and I'll be your host on this journey into the languages of the Haudenosaunee people. I am Mohawk in Tuscarora, and I live and work as a writer, a publisher, and a media producer from my home on Six Nations, or Oswego, as we call it. When I first opened the show, you heard me say Sego. That is a Gonyageha word for hello, but it's not spelled like it sounds. It's spelled SHE:KON. The letter K sounds like a G. The Mohawk language is called Gonyageha, and yep, you guessed it, those G sounds are actually spelled with K's. We have a local radio station on Six Nations called CKRZ-FM, 100.3 Voice of the Grand.